Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune, my co-hosts. Gents, welcome back. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
All good, guys.
Well, chaos on the streets of Los Angeles after US President Donald Trump ordered in the National Guard, the federal troops, to, in his words, sort out the mess that was happening. Protests we are seeing on levels that we haven't seen in the US for a very long time. Rocks being thrown, rubber bullets being shot by police officers, including at an Australian television news reporter, looting and all sorts of things. Now threats from the Californian governor, Gavin Newsom, that he will sue Donald Trump because he has overstepped the mark. Let's have a look at the various components of this. Ozan, starting with taking a step back here, what was happening in LA before Trump took this drastic action and made this enormous decision to send in the National Guard?
No, I think it's a good place to start because many people are probably following the end part of what's happened. But if you go back, I'm sure everybody is aware that one of the big election promises that President Trump made was to deport illegal migrants, those who are criminals, etc. And as part of that, over the last 4 or 5 months, the group called ICE, which is a federal immigration body, has basically, in many commentators' kind of words, been militarized as a tool to go around and round up a lot of people and subsequently deport them. The Trump administration has been under significant criticism for deporting people without due process, which is afforded to you in the US under the Constitution, whether you are a citizen or not. So there has been a very controversial part of his administration. And most recently in LA, there were a lot of instances where this organization, ICE, had been going to people's workplaces. In this case, it's undocumented migrants. There's no evidence that these people have, committed any crimes. And they've been going to certain workplaces with their masks on, in what can probably be accurately referenced as very intimidating kind of ways, and have been literally rounding people up and either deporting them or putting them in detention. And so I think what's happened in particularly last week was a number of workplaces were targeted. So a Home Depot and several other places were targeted. And, you know, word of mouth got around, and many of the people who were impacted by this, family members, friends, etc., of people who were being rounded up in this fashion, started to go and protest. And, word got out that they were going to target some other workplaces. And effectively, the protest started by a lot of people just coming out and protesting this way of rounding people up and deporting them and dealing with this with the kind of immigration issue. And to put simply, there are millions of undocumented migrants in the US. They form a very large part of the workforce, specifically in certain sectors. And at the end of the day, the narrative has changed to basically rounding up undocumented migrants, and rather than focusing on those who have recently come illegally or have committed crimes, are members of certain outlaw gangs, etc. So there's a real target. A lot of it has been around President Trump promising a very significant target of migrants to be deported, and by all accounts, it seems like the administration is well below that number at this point in time. So there's been a natural kind of ramping up, and it's been very indiscriminate from what is obvious. So people have gotten angry, they've gone and protested. But of course, as with all of these sorts of protests, there have been certain elements who have taken their anger to far greater levels and have started fighting with the police, burning cars and doing things that are just very silly. This is not the way to protest. I think this is a, it really devalues the cause, which the cause for peaceful protest in this case is a very worthy cause. I think people should be protesting when the federal government goes out there and does things without due process and illegally rounds up people with no evidence that they've been involved in any criminal activity or anything like that.
Yeah, Rodney, just on, I mean, that last point that Ozan made about protesting and the nature of protests, right? I think, isn't it fair to say that protests generally get out of control at some point? There is obviously the element of arguing that a peaceful protest is necessary and that, protesters should be careful with what they do and don't damage things, which is sort of the argument that we are seeing from the right and from the MAGA movement. But the reality is, I mean, protests on both sides get out of control. I mean, have a look at what happened in January, that infamous day of which protesters stormed the US Capitol building. I mean, that went to the proverbial very, very quickly. What's your view on what Ozan said about, protesters should be a little bit careful? They've sort of, I'm not saying that Ozan said this, but some of the view in the right is that, they've brought it upon themselves, they have just called for this, etc. This has been a rhetoric. I'm assuming it's not a view you subscribe to, but keen to hear your thoughts on that.
I think organized protest tends to stay better within the law, and it's the less organized and more spontaneous protests that tend to have a higher level of violence associated with them. I think the Capitol incident was is a distinct because it was organized to deliver violence. I don't think that's what's happening here, and it is very frustrating to people who support a cause they see as a just cause in terms of the protest by the actions of ICE, that it tarnishes their protest to have violence then associated with it. But when you organize any form of protest, there's always going to be some sort of elements which are more militant than others. These things are always pretty difficult to control. But the right to protest and the right to protest against government policy is a significant right in the West and in the US that it feels like the administration's trying to suppress, I'm going to say prematurely, and if anything, by putting the more militarized presence on the street of the National Guard and so on, nearly to invite those people to be targeted by the protesters as an opportunity to physically physical manifestation of their frustration with the broader government policy. And then the other thing, of course, is when you have any protest that turns slightly violent, there's people in particular where I grew up who enjoy the sport of recreational rioting, and they just join in irrespective of whether they see the merits of the protest or not. And that's when you also get then the American thing of looting and so on that also goes with these types of protests. I think for me, the interesting thing is that one, he's gone over the head of the governor. It's not without precedence, but it's without precedence for a very long time. And the irony is not lost on people that when Lyndon Johnson called in the National Guard, it was to protect the right to protest. It was civil rights protesters going from Selma to Montgomery. And George Wallace, the governor, didn't want the National Guard there to protect those people, and it was actually the right to protest that was being protected. Where arguably in this occasion, Trump's gone ahead over the head of the governor to suppress the right to protest, and that's something which, of course, is going to be worrying. But he's done his polling. He knows this is popular with people. He knows that these ICE interventions are popular with people, and there's going to be a substantial level of support for ICE being aggressively implementing the detaining of undocumented migrants and subsequent deportation. And that's because the people who largely vote for him or form the MAGA base are people who aren't going to be affected by this because it's not their friends, not their families, not their colleagues. They don't hang around Home Depot looking to get a few hours work below the minimum wage. It's not there. It's not people they associate with or know about in a personal level. So it's popular for the MAGA base. It's an opportunity to move the story away from his breakup with Elon Musk. And putting the National Guard there is just going to invite a greater level of violence from the protesters, which is going to, in the administration's expectation, lose popular support of people who support the protest, but feel uncomfortable with it manifesting itself in street violence.
That's a really interesting point, Rod, because I think how does the left play this? How do the Democrats now play this? Because if they support the protesters and the images that we've been seeing online and through social media and mainstream media, then they're in a bit of a sticky situation. If they support the heart of what the protesters are saying, then it's like, well, here's the battle of you know, the topic of immigration, which of course will rile up the MAGA movement and the right in particular. To that extent, Ozan, is this a smart move politically for Trump?
Look, I think that's a great question. However, before we get to that question, let's kind of put into context why Trump is actually doing this. And this is the next move in a long list of moves that he's taken over the last 3, 4 months to try and cement his grip on power. And, you know, he's effectively come into office and broken every norm. He's normalized this whole process of breaking norms and desensitized people to it. And this is just the next in that next kind of move in that list. You know, I think what, you know, let's have a look at why he's threatening to put the Marines on the streets. The, you know, why he's done it with the federal government, sorry, the federal the National Guard. You know, this isn't because he's committed to law and order. He wants to de-escalate the situation. He wants to fix it. It's certainly not these things because, as you guys have mentioned earlier, that, you know, he has a pretty poor track record when it comes to trying to de-escalate things. And, you know, when he talks about things like insurrection, etc., with reference to the what's going on in LA today, you might as well be thinking that he's talking about January 6th, because everything that happened on January 6th and his response was very indicative of the fact that he's not committed to law and order. He wants to escalate these things. And, you know, if you have a look at what's happened in the last 3 months on the economy, he is determined to create as much crisis, as much chaos as possible, so that effectively, you know, down the track, he can have the option for himself, and with the support of a very large chunk of the American people, I may add, he wants to have that option to do things like declare martial law. And these are things that, you know, it's not hyperbolic to suggest this. He suggested it on the campaign trail that he would like to be a dictator. And everything he's done is going towards removing one by one every little bit of checks and balances and every little bit of resistance that exists in the system, to him having effectively absolute power. And so that's the kind of backdrop. And, you know, and that if he has the right reasons to do it, the people will get behind him. So politically, this is not bad. But what all the Democrats can do is to effectively stand by the Constitution. Gavin Newsom going and saying that, you know, he's suing Trump over the illegality of this. You know, these are all the things that they can do. I think that it's, you know, on the immigration stuff, I think they've made a mistake. They've been talking a lot about, amongst themselves as well, trying to figure out how to deal with the immigration issue, given that it's something that's been pretty beneficial for Trump politically. But I think they need to go and fight, because at the end of the day, if they don't fight, you know, how can things get worse for them? I mean, their approval rating is probably the lowest in history, in their history. You know, they've got to fight and they've got to say enough of the chaos, and they've got to talk about the fact that, Effectively, every norm has been broken. This didn't have to be like this. You didn't. Yes, there were some cars burnt. There was some violence on the streets, etc. No request by the LAPD or the governor or anybody really involved in the effort to control this for any assistance. They had it under control, but that wasn't good enough for Trump, and Trump wanted to add more chaos into the equation. And the Democrats need to point this out. They need to talk about the fact that if you're sick and tired of the chaos, this is what President Trump wants to do. He wants to destroy the economy, and he wants to create chaos, because it fits his narrative and it gives him the ability to do a whole bunch of things. And cynically as well, I think why he's done this is also, he's not having obviously a great time with his ex-friend Elon, which we'll talk about in a second, I guess. But he's also having to cop a fair bit of political criticism over the what he calls the big beautiful bill, the budget bill that's in front of the Senate right now. So this is another distraction. He's trying to flood the zone. It's typical Trump. And yes, he will get, I think, some political mileage out of it. But again, the Democrats have a very, very clear choice here. They need to fight. Gavin Newsom needs to fight for state rights. And they need to be fighting on all of the principles that a majority of Americans claim that they support. Things like constitutional rights, the state's rights to the governor's rights to manage this sort of stuff. Putting Marines on the streets. This sort of imagery and visions on when people are seeing this, I can't say is going to be all that popular amongst people who are kind of independent and what have you, because it goes beyond the immigration issue. And the Democrats just need to make a bigger deal of these sorts of things. They need to put at the forefront the ugliness of everything that's going on, and the only reason why it's going on is because Trump is doing it. Trump created this mess.
There's also talk, Rodney, about the fact that part of the move here by Trump is to create this element of chaos and uncertainty and national emergency, which could play into escalating as much as potentially seeing the midterms being called off. How much of that do you think is weighing in on what is actually happening on the ground in the US?
Yeah, I don't think this is going to lead to elections not taking place or something like that. You know what I mean? As much as I'm concerned about what's happening in America, I don't think it's got to that level of craziness just yet. I do think it's an easy way for him to secure the base, find a black and white issue where a lot of people are on his side, and steer the conversation away from his legislation, his fallout with Elon Musk, and reassert himself as the strong man again, willing to take action. And as he likes to say, he's about law and order. And I think, when they had protests in 2020, they regret not acting quickly enough to deal with them, the Republicans. Or sorry, whenever it was during his first term. And yeah, I think this is we're going to deal with it this time. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of dealing with stuff, one way he has dealt with a relationship that was core to both his election and then the early days in the White House was, of course, with the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who has basically ended his relationship with Donald Trump in the most spectacular way possible and in the most expensive way possible, perhaps for Musk as well. Ozan, was it a surprise that the bromance, as it's been called, came to an end so quickly?
I don't think it was a surprise that it came to an end. I think what might have surprised some people is how it happened, because everything was pretty good one day, and then suddenly things just started going very bad for their relationship. I think looking at the political factors behind it, I think Trump, as he does with everybody that kind of is around him, etc. He had a use for Elon, but then quickly started to see that Elon was dragging him down politically. Elon was himself, well, had made himself quite an unpopular character, generally speaking. So he was a bit of a drag on Trump. So I think, Trump started to think, okay, well, I've got what I need. He's helped me significantly, etc. But it's time to kind of probably put a bit of a distance in the relationship and wrap things like Dodge up. Also, I think Trump was probably a lot of his advisors were probably in his ear, saying, "Look, you've got to get rid of this guy. He's not really done anything that he said he was going to do. Apparently, Dodge was supposed to cut $2 trillion from the budget, and the latest estimates are it's about $100 billion. So, I think a number of factors came to play, and it kind of happened very quickly, but not surprising that it happened. In fact, I was surprised that the relationship lasted this long, with two, it would be fair to say, pretty big egos in the room. It's certainly not something that I would have thought was going to be everlasting. But look, Elon's put himself in a very difficult position. He's backed himself into a corner. He's overplayed a lot of his cards. He's in a much worse position than I think than Trump will ever be, because at the end of the day, the MAGA movement doesn't follow Elon. They're very much committed to their leader, and he's suffering both commercially, financially, but also I think from the public opinion point of view, I don't think. I mean, there's been discussion of him trying to cause interference and trying to split the MAGA crowd, etc. I don't see that happening. I don't think, people loved Elon because he had money and a platform. But if he starts to do the things that he did over the last few days against the leader, then they're going to drop him pretty quickly.
It was pretty spectacular, Rodney, in the sense that Elon then left the movement, if you like, and the White House, and then claimed that Donald Trump was part of the Jeffrey Epstein files. I mean, that's an extraordinary claim to make. Donald Trump then replied with saying, this guy's lost his mind, etc. But what do you make of that sort of the breakup there and the ramifications politically for Trump?
Well, I've no idea whether Musk knows what's in the Epstein files, whatever those files are. But it was clearly the thing which he felt most hurtful to Trump at that point in time. And it hasn't driven for conservatives restating that these things have to be released and so on. And even though he's now deleted that tweet, I believe, it's now there as an issue. And the only way to dispel the suspicion is to release as much information as possible. And the longer that doesn't happen, the more awkward, I think, as an issue this becomes. So yeah, but it's not my favorite tweet. My favorite tweet, by the way, was of one of Musk's ex-partners, I think, mother of child number 14, who tweeted Donald Trump, or exed Donald Trump, tweeted Donald Trump, with "If you need any breakup advice, let me know," which I thought was really good. But yeah, I mean, Musk obviously th threw a lot of things. He then rode back, and there seems to be an effort to sort of close the gap. I know that people say Trump will forgive people who he's previously disagreed with, but I can't see it happening with this particular situation. I think Musk is definitely on the outside, and he looks silly. He looks silly because weeks ago he was wearing hats saying Trump is always right. He looks silly because it looks like he thought he could stay on, and he was managed out because of his unpopularity with the rest of the team. He looks silly because he's suggesting that he knew about some involvement with Epstein, that he was clearly prepared to accept whilst things were going his way, and only decided on his, position to throw out there when he's been moved out of the tent. He looks silly because he didn't get his own way with some of the policy areas of the big, beautiful bill. And he either did know about it and hoped he would change it, and it didn't happen because he wasn't persuasive enough, or he didn't know about it and he wasn't respected enough to have his views taken account in the first place. So none of this looks good for Musk, and it doesn't look bad for Trump, apart from the obvious allegation that's still floating around that he might have been involved in some pretty bad stuff, but we just don't know. And it depends whether the pressure to make disclosures on that point mount in a way that he has to then share whatever it is. But like anything with these things, what's in people's minds and what they associate with the blank information is possibly worse than what actually the facts are. So we shall see whether we find out anything further. But Musk certainly doesn't look good with his with this split.
It was, of course, that big, beautiful bill that sort of sparked, I guess, that initial outrage from Elon about raising the debt ceiling and just accumulating more debt. Effectively, him saying that he doesn't want the US to go bankrupt, etc. Trump and the Republicans are targeting the 4th of July, which is not that far away, to have this bill passed in the Senate. Ozan, take us through this big, beautiful bill, the BBB, or the One Big Beautiful Bill, I think is what it's actually what it's called. And what is it at the essence, or what's at the essence of it in terms of what Trump and the Republicans want to achieve from particularly a financial perspective in what they hope will be a boost to the US economy?
Look, what's the thing driving this bill? The main thing driving this bill is the renewal, which is due at the end of this year, of the tax cuts that Trump put in place in his first term. Everybody might remember that this was a big controversial issue. In fact, it was kind of one of the only legislative achievements that he had, where he's able to significantly cut the tax rate of middle to higher income earners. So a lot of that was due to expire at the end of this year. So he would be in a very difficult position politically if he didn't enable that and make that to happen. But of course, when we're talking pretty, the math doesn't lie. So at the end of the day, those tax cuts are going to continue to cost the budget, and that money needs to be found somewhere. And what they're talking about now is, a fresh round of tax cuts, which include significant tax cuts to people earning enormous amounts of money. I think it's for 450,000 or something like that, and then another bunch of tax cuts for people who are earning over $4 million. So many commentators and analysts have basically said that you'll get a tax cut if you earn over, $500,000. But those people who are earning between kind of zero and $30,000, are going to have less kind of take home pay. And some of the provisions in there around the Medicare and the Medicaid and the health cover for a lot of people, as people might be aware, the US has a has what was introduced by the Obama administration, affordable healthcare system, where people are able to get health insurance cheaper, those who need it. And a lot of this bill will effectively cut that out. And the estimates are that up to 11 or 12 million people might lose their health insurance as a result of this. And of course, in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, they're talking about significant cuts to it. And the spin that the administration has put is basically to say that they're only targeting fraud and misuse, etc. And those people who are receiving Medicare, Medicaid benefits who are not eligible, etc. But again, on, the kind of counter to that point is that most economists and experts are saying that there's not enough fraud happening. Certainly through the Dodge process, they didn't find enough fraud because nobody was actually charged with it. So they're saying that it's ludicrous to suggest that, cutting waste and fraud is going to help you to save 800 million, a billion dollars in savings. So all of this basically is meaning that the fiscal deficit is going to increase by $3 or $4 trillion. Hence, the ceiling, the debt ceiling has to increase. And obviously, we live in a very upside down world. This is something that the Republican Party of the 15 years ago would have vehemently opposed. But today, because Donald Trump wants to make this happen and have it, as one of the only probably legislative achievements he'll achieve, certainly until the midterms next year. He wants to push this through. So a whole bunch of people in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, have fallen into line. However, you have some people in the Senate who are saying that they oppose it. A few very, quite big conservatives, fiscal conservatives, are saying that. Some of the Elon lines around this is going to make us go bankrupt, etc. But look, most likely it's going to get through, and it's going to get through, and it's going to be, I think, pretty ugly for a lot of people. And it will be very interesting to see what the political kind of fallout of it will be. But of course, between now and July, we didn't talk about the birthday parade that that President Trump has organized for himself, under the guise of celebrating the 250th anniversary of the military, the U.S. Army. He's effectively organized a parade going through Washington of tanks and missiles and what have you, basically any the types of things you would see in North Korea. Yeah, that's also going to be a very interesting thing to watch.
Just when you think you've seen it all, there's another thing that Trump comes up with that keeps us talking. Well, let's head internationally now and have a look at the interesting turn of events that's escalated in the Russia and Ukraine war as peace talks sort of continue between diplomats from Kiev and Moscow. An incredible turn of events with Ukraine attacking airfields deep inside Russia, which some say were both strategic and symbolic blows to what is actually happening. Rodney, take us through the latest and what this all means in this escalating and never-ending war.
Well, look, I think the first point is there is an appetite for peace at the current time. The height of negotiations are all in relation to prisoner exchange. And I think the reason that there isn't an appetite for peace is no one's able to say really what the shape of a peace agreement might look like. I know that there's been some sort of perception in the West that maybe, Crimea is going to have to be ceded and the areas that Russia occupied from 2014, but prior to the current conflict, may have to be also lost to Ukraine. That's not been Ukraine's position, but it's also not Russia's position. It's not like Russia's saying we're prepared to retreat back to where we started a few years ago. There's no ability for Russia to accept anything other than what they have or a little bit better. And that's why they're talking about a buffer corridor in addition to the land that they've already acquired. So most of what's happening is in relation to a backdrop of there being peace talks, but no peace talks. And the willingness to participate in peace talks has been some sort of device to satisfy Trump's perception that people are willing to participate in peace talks without ever being hooked into a process that they can't get out of. So at the same time, Ukraine has clearly planned well in advance for what it's going to do in response to an anticipated Russian summer offensive, which is sort of underway anyway. And this operation, which will be the stuff of no doubt movies and books in the future. I don't know if it's called Spider's Web or Spider something else. Can't remember, but it was something like that. Spider's Web involved the moving of drones secreted in the top of containers on the back of lorries, proximate to a number of airfields where they were released and manually piloted. I understand rather than automatically piloted, though I'm not sure how that works with the distance involved. But anyway, to target and on Ukraine's account, destroy one third of the bomber fleet or capacity to fly these their older aircraft, but the aircraft they've been using to shoot the surface to ground ballistic missiles that they've been firing that Ukraine was having some difficulty stopping. So they're obviously trying to start a source. But what I think we're really seeing is Ukraine has a number of these operations planned to offset the propaganda that Russia may try to make from any sort of incremental advance on Ukrainian territory by these sort of spectacular, nearly sort of behind enemy lines type operations, where it shows that they have some level of support within Russia, within the borders of Russia. They have the capacity to operate there that Russia hasn't demonstrated really so far during the war within Ukraine, and they're really smart stuff. The only similar thing that's happened in recent times, that was sort of reflected on for its long-term planning was the Israeli pager secretion of explosives with Hezbollah, which again involved this sort of 12-month or more long-term plan to activate something when it was most needed. And it was followed up by another attack on the Kerch Bridge, which again has some strategic significance. So these are all operations that are designed to disrupt the ability of Russia to execute any effective summer offensive, and also deal with the propaganda publicity side of things. And on I mean, social media just poured out. So if you talk about the communication side, with loads of memes mocking Trump for "you don't have any cards" comment to Zelensky in the White House, and yeah, it shows, I guess, for Western allies and anyone who might be wavering in support of Ukraine, that Ukraine still has the capacity to inflict costly damage on Russian military capacity, infrastructure, and hardware.
Yeah, look, I think the Trump stuff is interesting in terms of it's very clear that Putin is really playing Trump, and it's much like what he's been unable to kind of do at the domestic front. He's also not been able to achieve any progress on finishing the war that was supposed to be finished in 24 hours. After he got elected, and it was 24 hours after inauguration, 24 hours after, or weeks now, and it's just that it seems like Trump, through his recent comments, has effectively said that these two are like two children fighting in the playground. Maybe we'll just leave it them to fight it out. So it looks like there might be maybe a bit of a retreat in terms of the US's involvement in trying to broker some sort of peace or ceasefire. But look, there's no future to this. There's no kind of off ramp or anything that is kind of could be considered as a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. As long as the EU and other allies continue to provide support to Ukraine. Ukraine obviously is well within its rights to defend its sovereignty against Russia, who is the aggressor. This thing will continue because, of course, Putin is not going to give up. So yeah, I mean, this could go on for years, if not longer. I mean, it's just there's no political end in sight, particularly if the US backs off, and which it looks like it's kind of being forced to do, because it's not, it doesn't, as Rodney said, the reality here is Trump doesn't seem to have any cards to affect any type of kind of impact or any long-lasting ceasefire.
Well, as always, it's one of those things that it's a wait and see with no ability to truly predict where it will go. Gents, wonderful picking the events of the last week with you on Put Simply This Week. See you next.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.